Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's webcast on using containers for agile and scalable releases. My name is Ian Philpott. I'm a technical evangelist at Microsoft in the Developer Experience Organization. You can find me on Twitter at tripdubroot. I'm here today with John Willis. John, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure, thanks, Ian. Yeah, my name's John Willis. I'm actually the Director of Ecosystem Development at Docker. Came in about a year and a half ago through an acquisition that we were doing kind of SDN and Docker stuff, and that team now has done a lot of the really cool networking stuff that you've seen kind of come out over the years.
Like the lib network.
Yeah,
and
lib
whatnot.
Network, and now even the mesh stuff that's
in the
new version. Just been an operations guy, operations infrastructure, data center person my whole life, DevOps. Okay.
DevOps, right. Yeah, and I think you just got a new book coming out, right?
DevOps. Yeah, really good. I've been working with Gene Kim, the Phoenix Project author, Jez Humble, pretty good crew. We finally got the book to print. It's called The DevOps Handbook. It's orderable on Amazon. It really covers the spectrum.
That's awesome. Very cool. Yeah. So kind of that's the underlying principles that we're talking about today. Open source on Azure, as well as using DevOps to gain that velocity that we want in our software development organizations. With that said, industries and our customers, we're seeing the expectations really changing, and it's all due to the cloud. And I think that that really kind of goes without saying, especially the approach to development these days. We're all about that velocity. How do we get to production as quickly as possible? And with that kind of changing landscape, one of the things that we're seeing is that every company is really becoming a software company, and they're using different software development practices and things like that to really differentiate. And you've got a couple of different categories here. You've got existing companies using this to kind of disrupt their own company and the way they do things. And then you also have companies entering into different industries that are really disrupting that industry as at large. I think a perfect example of that is GE. GE really, their CEO recently has come out and said that they want to be one of the top 10 software development companies in the world. And that's not really what you think about when you think about GE. You think about lean manufacturing and thing like that. But one of their big focus points really is optimizing not only their manufacturing environment, but also optimizing the things that they manufacture out in the field. So, if you've flown recently, you've probably used, the plane probably uses one of their turbines, and collecting that information, that's one of the partnerships that we have with them, helping them to collect that information in the cloud and make decisions based on that. I think another perfect example is, of course, NBC. I think this is a very timely show of a company who is wanting to show the Olympics, but not just on television sets across America. They want to show it on every device type across America. And to do that, they really had to come out to the cloud and start thinking about how to deliver software to all of these devices. Another, that's, a great example. Netflix. This is an example of a company who came into an industry and completely disrupted it. First by mail order, and then they found that they could be most disruptive when they went into the software business and delivering movies and televisions to different devices. And they're really driving that that industry. And you see companies like Blockbuster and competitors like that just kind of fall by the wayside. And that's all through this changing landscape of companies really differentiating themselves through software development. Lastly, I love the example of the ride-sharing applications that we have on our phones. When's the last time that you've taken a taxi? I was just in Seattle, and getting from the airport back out to my hotel, I fired up a ride-sharing application and used that. So they're really disrupting that industry through software, and I think you see that with all the taxis protesting and striking around the world, in fact, to keep these types of ride-sharing apps out. And there again, perfect example of software. Now, With that said, all of the software, to release the software and really to be competitive in this space, one of your main focuses has to be on developer productivity. And I love the fact that Microsoft's mission is to bolster the productivity of every person in the world. And Solomon there, next to Satya, he has a very similar mission for Docker to basically improve all productivity for all developers all over the world. So I think, you know, it's a great partnership that you see there between our two missions, and our customers are going to greatly benefit in that world. With that said, containers, today's topic, they fit perfectly in our tenets for our cloud. They help enable Microsoft as well as our customers to provide that hyperscale environment. Also, with the availability, with the boot times and seconds and things of that nature, it allows us to bring up entire stacks in different locations very quickly. And all of that plays perfectly into the agility and speeding up developer productivity. With that said, Docker entered the scene, and you know, I'll let the expert kind of talk a little bit about Docker and you know, why containers.
Well, thanks, Ian. Yeah, no, I mean, I was just thinking about that picture, Satya and Solomon, right?
Yeah.
These are two incredible disruptors that are just driving everything you just said about software.
Yeah.
You know, Marc Andreessen says software is eating the world, right? And I, you know, I say that, you know, if you don't know you're in the software business, then you're probably not in business.
Right.
Right. So, yeah, the interesting thing about Docker is I think their mission was always to solve the software developer productivity thing. So they started actually, most people might not know, they started out as a public pass.
Right.
Right. And it was, and it was that same kind of motivation for developers to not get bogged down with all the inertia of infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And the, you know, at the time there were really three passes. You know, there was Heroku, there was Engine Yard, and Solomon was the founder of a company called .cloud. And the idea was the developer could just put in a small set of metadata,
mm-hmm.
put the code in a place, and infrastructure happened.
Right.
Right. But at the time, there was a really small subset of people that they were really getting that message to.
Yeah.
You know, one-off projects, some startups with web pages, and it was a very competitive business. So Solomon had this idea that all these companies knew something that nobody else knew, which
yeah.
was the way you build that kind of infrastructure to make that ease of use.
Right.
Is there was some hidden gems in the Linux operating system.
And those hidden gems were not very easy to use.
They would have been around forever, but just really, you know, we talk a lot in DevOps about unicorns and horses, right?
Yeah.
Unicorns work at Microsoft, at Google,
right.
and these kind of places. And the rest of us, you know, well, there was these unicorn people that were building, you know, taking things like Linux containers, C groups, namespaces, and gluing it all together for their purpose of this developer productivity.
Right.
Solomon had this vision, and it was, what if I kind of turn that around, instead of just trying to get the small subset, let's take all this code that we have, let's turn it into an open source project and see if we can't create that same
away, yeah.
level of productivity for everybody in every platform across the board. And that basically became Docker
right.
and his vision and his success of trying to get to a world where everybody gets to just, or developers just get to, I want to write my code.
Right, I just give me a metadata file.
And just let me put some meta.
Yeah,
and then the decision-making process about engineering, release engineering, all that stuff is handled by the system. And,
right.
and that's been really the success of Docker.
And then recently you just had 1.12 drop, right, where you've integrated that even into some of the product, the engine.
Yeah, I met Solomon years ago when he was kicking off. I mean, you meet this guy, you get the vision of where he's going. And,
right.
And so at DockerCon this year, you know, we introduced the 1.12.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is Docker made this great presentation where he said, you know, in the keynote, he said, we didn't invent containers. Containers have been around,
mm-hmm.
Done open story, everybody knows about. We just made them really easy to use.
Yeah.
And then he goes into, which was really interesting for me, because my whole careers have been about orchestration
right.
and the complexity of orchestration. He says, the follow-on, he says, we didn't invent orchestration. It's mm-hmm. been around forever. We just made it simple to use.
And that swarm mode.
And it was just to see that.
Yeah.
And what it was really for people, we had a swarm orchestration. We had a Docker engine.
Yep.
And we just combined it, again, letting the developers have the simplicity of just, you know, putting my code in a place.
Yeah.
It gets Dockerized, it gets containerized, now it gets orchestrated.
Exactly. So I think that's a great segue into kind of a typical use case here at Contaso. We have a ride-sharing application. You know, it's got an app that runs on iOS. It's got an app that runs on Android. And it's since we're a rapidly growing company, there are a few people started out. We kind of built this monolithic application. And as we started adding on new developers, so let's say we have a new, or not a new developer, but an existing developer. His name's Ringo, let's say. And Ringo, he works on the API's HTTP endpoint code. And when he wants to make changes to that, he's got to test the entire monolithic application and kind of ship that out to production. And then you've got George, let's say. He's a developer who works on maybe the communication with Redis or something to that effect. Same problem. When he makes changes, he's got to get those changes over to Ringo, and then, you know, we got to ship it all out. I mean, have you heard this type of story?
Yeah, no, I think it plays very well into this idea that, you know, once you can get down to this just simple composition of what you do,
yeah,
and that is the abstraction layer,
right?
Then Ringo and Paul and yeah, all the players of yeah, the band who orchestrate music in the generic
exactly
set, right, get to play together at a high level abstraction, right? And that's where the kind of container, the composition, and the software development flow
right
really gets exciting, because in your case, Ringo can make his subtle changes,
right,
and it's not like, okay, now we're going to have to get everybody in a room to figure out how the monolith is going to work.
Yeah.
I can just basically
focus on this microservice.
Focus on this change,
yeah,
and what will happen is, because of the composition and sort of the container immutability, as it gets into the flow, then it gets tested against the whole structure,
exactly,
just like it did in Longway.
The integration tests.
But the brittleness and, right, of the changes, they get caught at the next level.
Exactly. So I think, you know, that's a very compelling story of taking, you know, that monolith and breaking it up by domain and down into microservices, and each one of those microservices consisting of a container, essentially. But, you know, that kind of also begs to question about a new developer. Let's say a new developer, Yoko, starting. You know, she's, of course, the disruptive one, typically. But she comes in and starts. And under that monolith kind of service-oriented architecture that we talked about, she would have to, you know, spend 4 to 5 days working with the ops guys, probably trying to figure out all of the different pieces and parts to this development environment. And, you know, might take a couple of weeks before she's even checking in code. But under like a Docker-based microservices using containers, you can get that metadata file and basically spin that up an entire set of containers and be committing code by the end of the day. So, you know, let's say she's assigned a bug on day one to fix. She comes in, you know, taps out some code, and there she goes.
Yeah, you know, and, you know, Yoko's a disruptor. She's got a little different pitch and voice.
Right.
So, but in our kind of, you know, metaphor of how this works, maybe the rest of the team is using a different language. You know, they're all kind of a C++. And this disruptor got bought in to do some new things with some data science stuff.
Python.
And she, right, yeah, and she wants to use Python. Now, the old world, first thing she'd have to do is go dissect the monolith source code, mm-hmm, dissect then the infrastructure release engineering inertia that makes all that work,
right,
find out that this team has no release engineering scripts for all that stuff.
Exactly, yeah.
Go find the group that might have it. You know, literally, she's not productive for a month. Day
exactly
one, she comes in, she understands the composability architecture.
Right.
She's immutable in what she delivers,
and
she
it
fits right in.
Changes the way devs do feature work. I mean, I think that's exactly.
Hopefully the Beatles don't break up, but we'll be all right.
Exactly. So that kind of begs the question, what is a container? And I think it's best contrasted with VMs. And I really love the way you kind of put that out there. I've heard you talk in the past, and some of the ways you describe it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the simple things when people look at a container versus a VM, right? The way you describe it simply, your picture is really good. Like where each compute instance is the full stack of the operating system, and you know, so it's kind of really fat by definition. It takes much longer to instantiate. But if you look kind of at the right hand of the slide, really what we do is, some people refer to this as kind of OS level virtualization. We're really, you're basically sharing the host operating system. And so you're really kind of componentizing down to really the application.
Yeah. Exactly.
Now you get some of the kind of operating system things like booting and stuff like that. But in general, that you get this size. But then the size, the density shrinkage gives you speed.
Right.
Because, you know, it usually, virtual instances might take a couple of minutes to instantiate. A container instantiates in 400 or 500 milliseconds.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about it. And so essentially with the virtual machine, you have a hypervisor layer, an entire operating system where your application runs on top of that. And then if you want to scale that out, of course, you got to duplicate the entire operating system and boot that up. And you've got, you know, a bit of lead time for that. Whereas just the container, you're sharing resources of the underlying operating system. So when you're booting it up, basically you're just...
And I think if we could circle that back to the public class idea, right? I mean, today, for the most part, a developer, his or her first abstraction is the operating system.
Right.
You want to remove that, just remove that abstraction.
Yeah.
I don't, as a developer, care where you're going to place this image that is my code.
Yeah.
I don't have to worry whether it's what type of operating system it is. Is this something special I have to do if you switch from, a Red Hat to a Ubuntu? Do I have to worry about where it lies, in Azure or in a private
right.
infrastructure? So once I get this to this immutable container thing, the application developer has all this freedom of, I'm just getting my code, and it's very much like the past thing. I just push it with my meta, my composition data, and like the rest of that stuff gets figured out.
Exactly. Well, with that said, we'll come back in and start exploring a little bit about Azure. Now, I want to kind of level set a little bit here. Recently, we've come out with scale sets, which essentially allows you to take an image of a VM, and typically that image would either have your application already installed or it'd have your configuration management tooling installed into it. And essentially, this allows you now to automatically do scaling across virtual machines very simply and very easily. And that's what the scale sets technology in Azure really provides you. The reason I wanted to kind of bring this back around to some of the underlying VM architecture that we're talking about is because that's exactly what the Azure Container Service is built upon. so this allows us to build a cluster of machines that consists of nodes as well as master to handle the orchestration. And the idea here is really when I have one of these composed files that contains multiple services by container images within it, when I hand this off to the master node and it does its orchestration, it boots those containers up across the cluster so that, and Docker using some of the lib network and things like that, hooks all of these up to talk together, and it's just done for you. You don't even have to worry about it. It's really kind of a thing of beauty. So with that said, I want to go ahead and jump right into the demo that we have today, where we're going to be demoing a Docker Swarm using the Azure Container Service. So I'm going to come out of the PowerPoint now, and we will come over to our Azure portal. Now, all of this can be done from the command line, either using the Azure CLI on a Linux, Mac, or Windows host. That's kind of our cross-platform CLI. Or you can do it from PowerShell. But I'm just going to do it directly from the portal today. So we'll come down, and you see down here in the marketplace, we have a container section. And then within this container section, I have the Azure Container Service. So we'll go into the Azure Container Service. And this just kind of describes it. We'll just click Create and move along. And this is just some of the basic configuration settings. So I'll create a username. I'll go with my preferred one, tripdubroot. And if you're curious about that, it's www.root folder in IIS. It's kind of where that comes from. And I'll grab my SSH key here, And this will allow us to create an SSH tunnel or connect essentially to the host using SSH, because these are Linux hosts. And I'm going to create a resource group. Now, a resource group is a unit that allows us to manage the entire cluster as a single unit, which can be kind of dangerous. So we'll say TDR MTC swarm demo 01. And I'm going to go ahead and create this in the East US data center. You see that there's a bunch of different data centers that you can create this in. I'll go ahead and click OK. And we can choose the framework version here. You have the choice of DCOS or Swarm. So I'm going to go ahead and choose Swarm and hit OK. And here we can choose the agent count as well as the master count. I'm going to go with just three agents, and these are basically the nodes in which the containers will run on. And then, of course, the master is what controls the orchestration. And we'll just give this a prefix for DNS and hit OK. And then this is just a summary page, and I can download a JSON file and use it to deploy from the command line if I'd like. I can just hit OK. And then, of course, here's the loading up the terms of services. And once that loads up, I'll just go ahead and click purchase, basically saying that I agree to the terms of service. And we see that the deployment has started. All right. And you can come in here and use this to monitor the deployment. But just kind of to save some time, I went ahead and pre-staged a deployment here, a couple, in fact, where I come over here. And I have the MTC swarm demo set up right here. We see that the deployment succeeded. And throughout here, you can see that I have a swarm master VM, a couple of swarm nodes, virtual machines in here. And then, of course, I have this master IP. And this is really kind of what we want to use. We're going to essentially, this is a little bit hokey. And this is not how you'd go to production with it, but this is just an easy way to demo. I'm going to create an SSH tunnel that allows me to forward all of my Docker commands over that tunnel to my master here. In a production environment, you might use something like ExpressRoute or just a VPN to the virtual network that this cluster is running on to kind of bypass doing this tunnel thing. But with that said, you grab this DNS name right here, and I kind of already have this staged up for us. And I'll open my command prompt, which is already open. I'll go ahead and just close that from before, and paste that in, hit enter. And we'll see that it should create a tunnel. And now I have a tunnel that I will tell the Docker client using the dash H command here to connect to my localhost 2375, which is the Docker port, which basically forwards that on to my master in the swarm, and get the info off of that. So that's actually running a command on the swarm within Azure. And to kind of prove that out, we'll say, we'll come up here and change that to Docker run hello world, which is kind of the you know, the developer de facto hello world to run. And you're not going to see much here because it's not redirecting the output here. But if I come in and I say Docker ps-a to show me everything that's run on this swarm, you'll see that I have a second instance here of hello world from before, from just now. So essentially, I know now, I know that I have a good working Docker swarm running in Azure just by clicking a few buttons, and you know, 5 minutes later it's up and running. Now, kind of coming back to our conversation where we're working with Yoko and she enters in with day one, you kind of pointed me to a app, so I'm kind of playing Yoko here. You pointed me to an app and said, hey, we have a voting app that we showed off at, I guess, DockerCon.
DockerCon, yeah. It was very popular. Very simple kind of voting app. It's actually in GitHub, Docker. It's It's basically, I think it's example-voting-app. So anybody can literally download. So what you did, I mean, we're going to do that because it had to bring up all the services, but basically you would say compose up against a composition file. You have that comp file right there.
Yeah, let me pull that composition file up.
So this is really interesting. So if you look at this, so Yoko walks in. And again, we made this kind of for fun. If you install it and you run it, you'll see.
While you're talking, why don't I just run it real quick?
Oh, there you go. Oh, wow. Well, yeah. There you go. How easy this stuff is to do. I mean, we just downloaded this stuff 30 minutes ago.
Docker compose help. Let's say it has a dash H just like Docker. So I should be able to just say docker-compose-h, and of course I need to be in the directory, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and in this directory I see there's a docker-compose.yaml file.
Right.
So I'll do just what I was about to do and just kind of change this to docker-compose, and that's it.
Yeah, basically. I think you might want to put the dash D, but
just dash so D that, up.
Yeah, because then it'll start
to daemonize it, right?
Yeah,
kind of thing. Okay, and let's see.
Oh, my bad. You just go with the original one you said.
Yeah, we'll
take the dash D out.
We'll take the dash D out and just run up. Okay, and that's going to go off and start downloading images into the swarm. And tell us about these images that it's downloading.
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of interesting thing here, right? Like, we did it for fun because it throws up two screens and you get the cats versus dog, and then people will hit the URL. Every time you vote, I like cats, and cats go up and dogs.
Okay, so you can kind of vote.
And you know, if you go back and watch some of the keynotes that we did DockerCon, we did some fun stuff where people put other challenge stuff, but ops versus dev, right?
Yeah, right.
But what's behind this shows kind of a really good example of complex composition proposed very simply.
Right.
Because what this is behind the scenes is it's kind of a Python Django app. It's got a Node.js. It's got Redis. It's got a Postgres. We even have a .NET version, right? So combined with this. So you've got a lot of kind of reasonably complex frameworks with fair amount of code built around that.
Right.
So going back to Yoko. Yoko comes in and says, okay, how do I figure out where all this code is?
Mm-hmm.
How do I figure out how it connects to the infrastructure?
Right.
And and again, that's let's go back maybe 8-10 years ago, that was what I always joked. Like Bob's script library.
Right.
And you better know where Bob is, and don't get him mad because he'll throw you out of his office if you annoy him. And Yoko had to go in there and beg and plead to find out how this got all tied together. And God forbid she wanted to add another language in.
Right.
And then you go over the last 10 years, we had this great success with infrastructure as code.
Yeah.
Right? Things like Chef and Puppet. And
mm-hmm.
But even there, Yoko has to go in and start looking at...
Figuring that stuff out,
It's easier than having a fight with Bob.
Right.
But she can go in and at least say, hey, you're going to have to pull out this book, learn Ruby a little bit, learn a little bit about the primitives of this cool Chef or Puppet thing.
Right.
And, I'm a Chef expert, and that's not easy, right?
Sure.
So now, Yoko's not productive, maybe not for a month.
Yeah.
If you bring up the compose file...
And then we come back to our compose file, yeah, sure.
And we did
it's
great job.
Pretty simple.
Yeah, you look at that compose file. We just tell Yoko, basically, this is the infrastructure meta for how this
works. Got a website, Redis, a database, and a worker.
In Bob's script world, that's a bunch of bash scripts hidden.
I love it.
In the Chef and Puff world, it's hundreds of lines of primitives. Yoko, and to the point we made earlier, Yoko needs to change the game.
Yeah.
She just needs to, it's back, we've gone full circle to the past world.
Right.
It is now that the day one worker gets what the web developers had in the Heroku engine yard. They get to just pop in their code with a little meta and they get to get the infrastructure that they deserve.
That's perfect.
Yeah,
that's perfect. Well, I think that's all we had today. So I will kind of say that if you're interested in discussing project opportunities with Microsoft, go ahead and shoot me an email. Also, please follow me on Twitter at TripDubRoot, and we can talk there. And in Atlanta, we're going to be having a container camp on 8/24. So if you're interested in that, go ahead and shoot me an email, and I'll be happy to follow up with you on that. So with that said, I'll go ahead and start taking some questions.
What new security strategies does my team need to consider with containers?
It's interesting. That's a very good question. I think you've got a couple of different strategies to kind of worry about here. The first one, I think, being, of course, with the whole VM, can you, with the red pill, can you get into the another container from this container? And I think namespaces and a lot of that infrastructure is already built, so we're not going to worry too much about that part of the security.
We've cleaned a lot of that stuff. We got user space namespaces.
Right.
So if you know, you can be a different user in the container. So we've done a tremendous job on the security space from container to container.
I think the other piece is then just our pipeline. One thing that I would be concerned with is, of course, these image files that I would be putting up on, like, the registry. That being compromised and getting put into the registry, and there being some code in there, I don't want it executing. I mean, do you guys...
Yeah, no, you know, so it's funny because early on, you know, in the Docker story, the first story was this kind of host, you know, host container relationship, what's the vulnerabilities there. And then the bigger story that started coming out, which was, oh my God, you could pull any image off the internet and run it and you won't know.
Right.
By the way, that was the same argument we had with Chef and Puppet back when. When you pulled a
cookbook
off the
right.
Like, if you didn't know what it was when you installed stuff, like, bad things could happen.
Yeah.
But, you know, here's the interesting flip, right? Like, it's a lot easier to scan a container. So when you start, like, either you do it through your continuous delivery pipeline, which many people do, they'll invoke vulnerability scanning in the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier when it's all condensed in a microservice, in an immutable structure. It's just easy to identify. It's identify what the impact is. It's easier to identify what the impact is once it's loaded in production.
And then your trusted registry has this
feature. Right, our trusted
registries,
we have the Nautilus, we have the scanning. So we've got that all now built in. We have something called Docker Data Center, right, which is kind of our, if you want the full enterprise version of what we do, you get a trusted registry, you get vulnerability scanning built into it, you get LDAP integration with, you know, and you get all those things built in with a full running suite of orchestrated containers.
Yeah, and you get the dashboard on top of Swarm and
so
all that.
So all the things that look really ugly about container and security, particularly the image, actually when you put it into the pipeline flow and you get something like a registry where they're getting scanned as they get put in the industry, it actually gets a little tighter and cleaner than most of the stuff people are running non-containerized.
Exactly. Great. That's great. Any other questions?
What kind of cost and consumption changes will we see with the implementing containers?
Okay, well, I mean, that's a great question and certainly a big concern as we move kind of from that CapEx to OpEx type of model. This is what I showed you today, running Docker Swarm or any of the other orchestration products within Azure. Essentially, what we're doing, again, is using scale sets on top of IaaS. So this is really just a compute cost. So I stood up 4 VMs, so you'd be getting, you know, kind of charged for 4 VMs. You'd have the storage costs, as well as some of the network egress costs. But that's all pretty typical. I don't think there's gonna be really any other type of costs associated with that. Now, Docker, you have some like trusted registry and
I think there's, you know, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that when people talk about kind of getting density with compute from virtualization, like the balance of cost from kind of a, you're going to wind up paying for compute. If you're going to grow compute, which is, if you're going to be a software business, you're going to grow compute.
Right.
The question then becomes the OpEx cost of how you deliver software. And those are the nasty costs that you actually start reducing.
Right.
Microservices, bounded context, you know where things are.
You don't have a developer sitting around for 2 months when they start.
It's easier
not doing
to, you know, in DevOps we say that developers should wear pagers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So imagine if the developer developed this kind of immutable structure on their laptop and it's bit for bit the same in production.
Yeah.
Right. So then the battle of where the problem lies, it gets really shortened, and so what you really wind up seeing is this overall kind of hidden operational cost of how you do business gets reduced.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. Outside of cost, yeah, outside of the compute cost. Any other questions for us?
For your new dev, Yoko, what level of knowledge or training about containers is needed?
I don't think very much at all. Of course, as time progresses, she's going to have to certainly learn about the full stack of the application, unless you have her kind of focused in on just one area. But I think from what you saw there, I could very easily and simply give her an icon that did exactly what I just ran on a virtual machine located on her box and stands up, 50 different containers on that one VM. And then when she checks in her code, your CI/CD process would just pick that up. And
yeah. I think the point that was made earlier about if Yoko was bound to the operating system and bound to the framework that operating system run on. So I'm Yoko, I got to get this application. Oh, you better learn Ubuntu. And you got to put it in Ubuntu. And then she deploys it in Ubuntu and somebody yells at her, hey, we're a Red Hat shop. Why didn't you do this? Red Hat, Ubuntu, why are you bothering me, right?
Right.
Again, when you kind of interlayer another abstraction,
yeah,
all those things that Yoko was going to get yelled at, like, you didn't understand how networking was going to work when it worked on Azure versus the private infrastructure. You didn't understand the image change. There's all these mismatch impedances of what a developer wants to do and what actually where it lies in production.
Yeah.
So in general, Yoko doesn't have to learn, if Yoko doesn't want to, all those things that kind of in small ways get in the way of her just delivering software.
Exactly.
So and the answer is, really, she doesn't have to really know containers.
Yeah. I think that's...
She has the metafile and the application code that she builds.
I just ran one command and there it goes. All right. Well, that's all the questions we have for today. Thanks for joining us. And we'll finish up here. John, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, that's great.